In today's episode, we get to talk with world-renowned trauma therapist and creator of sensory motor psychotherapy, Dr. Pat Ogden, PhD. Join us as Dr. Ogden shares with us wisdom from her 50 years of practice. We dive into the interplay between the nervous system, the body, beliefs and emotions, how to stay in the body even when we don't like the sensation, and what will be some of the ramifications from COVID-19. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Inspire Health Podcast. And today we are kicking off our series on trauma recovery with an avatar in this field, Dr. Pat Ogden. Pat Ogden, PhD, is a pioneer in somatic psychology and both founder and education director of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, an internationally recognized school specializing in somatic cognitive approaches for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and attachment disturbances. She is co-founder of the Hakomi Institute, a clinician, consultant, international lecturer, and trainer, and first author of Trauma and the Body, a Sensory Motor Approach to Psychotherapy. Her second book, Sensory Motor Psychotherapy, Interventions for Trauma and Attachment, is a practical guide to integrate sensory motor psychotherapy into the treatment of trauma and attachment issues. Dr. Ogden is currently developing sensory motor psychotherapy for children, adolescents, and families with colleagues. Pat, what an honor to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Jason. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be able to talk to you today. I found when you start to investigate the world of trauma recovery and working with trauma, you can only go so far before your name keeps popping up over and over again. So you have a long history within this arena of working with trauma, and I'm wondering if we can break things down a little bit, and maybe first just how did you come to develop sensory motor psychotherapy, and what were some of the main influences that got you into this area?
That's been a long journey. In my professional life, I suppose it started in the 70s, the early 70s. I was working in a psychiatric hospital, and I was teaching yoga and dance, and I discovered that the patients who did both those classes seemed to get better faster. Maybe they were going to get better anyway, but it really piqued my interest in the value of the body for healing. You know, later, I thought about it, and I thought about Steve Porges' work, and I think it's probably had to do with the fact that the yoga classes were very slow, very relaxed, very easy. Patients could come and go. So it kind of stimulated the dorsal vagal branch of the nervous system, but without the fear, which we know is healing for trauma. And then the dance classes were really high energy classes that stimulated the sympathetic system. So I really wonder if that's not why they got better. But that was kind of the beginning for me. And in the midst of that, I think in 74, I met Ron Kurtz, who's a body therapist. He was the pioneer of the Hakomi method. And Ron was the first person I met who integrated the body into psychotherapy, mainly looking at how the body holds attachment failures. So I was really enamored of his work and moved to Colorado with him and apprenticed with him. And together we co-founded the Hakomi Institute, as you mentioned, in 1980. In many ways, I learned the most from my patients, especially college students from Wardenburg Clinic here at the University of Colorado. I was an adjunct therapist for that clinic in the 70s, and I was referred women who were having trouble with their sexuality. In those days, the term was pre-orgasmic. They couldn't enjoy sex. And I was working with these women in the way that I had learned in social school and through Ron primarily, which was really going through strong emotions and childhood issues. And I was actually horrified to find out that my patients, some of them, got worse. Nobody was talking about trauma back then. I think Charles Frigley's book may have come out, but we were over a decade away from Judy Herman's book, Trauma and Recovery, that was published in 1992. So I had no idea or methodology to work with trauma. All these women had been sexually abused. And I remember thinking, maybe I could just keep them in their bodies. Maybe I could just go slower and not go for the strong emotions, because that seemed to make things worse for them. And that really helped. So I learned so much from those particular patients. At that time, I was also studying various kinds of body work, hands-on body work, postural integration, later Rolfing movement, and the Rolfing method of structural integration, which really works with alignment in the body and differentiation of movement and finding your peace with gravity through an aligned spine. Dr. Rolf talked about the core, meaning the spine around which everything rotates. So all the study I did with hands-on body work was a huge influence. And I would say before that, even as a child, my mother put me in dance class when I was 7 years old because she knew I was going to be tall. And she said, if you're tall, you're going to be graceful. She was an artist. So for 11 years, I studied dance. And I still remember that feeling of that length in my body and that poise when I was a little child, that my dance instructor was trying to impart to all of us.
It's neat that you mentioned dance too, because I know when my wife and I will go sometimes and we'll do courses at the Kripalu Institute. Uh-huh. And one of our favorite parts about that is at noon, if we get done our class on time, we rush down to go and do the hour of dance that goes on from 12 till 1.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In a lot of ways that we often find like that being really some of the most therapeutic part, regardless of even what we're taking from a course or whatnot, is the movement aspect of it. And it is interesting as to what it is about it that I find so beneficial, whether it's just the freedom of expression, or even when you talked about Rolf, you know, I'm an osteopath as well. And so my background around osteopathy, it's like we look at fascial chains. And in osteopathy, we talk a lot about even the fascia holding a lot of emotional energy in them. And so movement and dance and Rolfing, you know, myofascial work, I feel like in a lot of ways that interconnects those worlds around emotions and the physical body. And you see it enough times, you just get that that's the way it works after a while.
Yeah. I know what you mean. It's interesting because I was Rolfed for the first time in the late 70s by Emmett Hutchins, a master Rolfer, one of the first two people Ida Rolf authorized to teach her work. And as he was, you know, working on my body, there was no psychotherapy, but all these issues would come up and these memories. And he would say, well, you know, take them to your therapist. And so then I'd go to my therapist, but, you know, they weren't as immediate as they were when I was being Rolfed. And I thought, I want to bring the two disciplines together somehow. And for a while in the 80s, in the early 80s, I was teaching hands-on body work, called it Hikomi body work there then, along with psychotherapy. But what I found, it was just too complex to teach because people had to have tremendous skills as a body worker and the skills as a psychotherapist. And blending them was just problematic. But I feel in my own work now, I get the same benefit. People change, their bodies change, their movements change. You know? So,
yeah. Can you break down a little bit about as far as the sensory motor psychotherapy, like what have you integrated that makes it different from what most people think about when they go and talk to their psychotherapist or work through? What are the different pieces that get brought into it?
Well, the biggest difference, it's not just working with emotions or working with beliefs and thoughts. It's really looking at how the body participates in every single difficulty a client has. I always would tell my students, when your client comes with a presenting problem, you can be assured that the body is sustaining and reflecting that problem in some way. Therefore, you know, we can address it directly through the body. So that's in a nutshell. I mean, you know, it's much, much more involved than that. But in a nutshell, we're looking at those three levels of the belief systems in our, that we hold, the meanings that we make, our emotions, our emotional habits, and then the nervous system, the posture, the structure, the movement of the body as well, and how those interface. You know, they interface very differently with trauma and developmental or attachment issue. And that was something that was a really big learning, because when I started out as a therapist, like I said, nobody was talking about trauma. It was just about not even attachment, but relationship and your family dynamics. So I kind of learned the hard way through my clients what was trauma and what was more related to those attachment needs.
Well, that brings me to another question, is how do you define trauma? I mean, I remember one way that resonated with me, well, I remember I was doing a course with Dr. Peter Levine, and he talked about it as you're kind of on this river of life, and that stressors are kind of like the big rocks that get in the way that you have to kind of work around or figure out how to, and they can be big obstacles. Right. But he said trauma is almost like a, you know, like a black hole that gets in your river that just pulls you in, and you almost like a big whirlpool, you just can't even get out. So everything just keeps revolving around that. But how do you describe trauma? What is trauma from a sensory motor psychotherapy perspective?
The way I see trauma is that it has less to do with the event and more to do with the nervous system and the muscular system of the body, the instinctive system. Because something that's traumatizing that pulls you into that vortex, as Peter would say, for one person might not be for another. Like, I always think of children, because for some kids, hearing their caregivers yelling in the next room is traumatic for them. And it's traumatic for them because it stimulates their arousal, like over that window of tolerance, so they're hyper aroused. And when arousal is stimulated like that, it's you lose your neocortex, you lose your thinking brain. It's really the instincts that take over. So when an event stimulates arousal that's outside of the window, it goes hand in hand with instinctive defensive responses that are elicited when we feel threatened. So we have impulses to cry for help, fight, flee, you know, freeze, or collapse into a feigned death mode. And it's when those responses, that dysregulated arousal and those primitive instinctive defenses are triggered, that is a trauma for that person. There was a psychiatrist named Ross in World War II, and he said every person has the breaking point. So some events would be traumatic for everybody. But people have different thresholds for different events as to what will stimulate those responses in them. And I think that's really misunderstood, because people usually think of trauma as the event itself rather than how it affects the person's nervous system and their somatic system, and how it affects the brain. Mm-hmm.
So you'd kind of mentioned that a little bit, but what would predispose someone to becoming traumatized versus someone that might have more resilience from becoming traumatized? So they, you know, you have three different people that experience the same type of event. What I'm trying to always figure out is, how do you build resilience from things, almost like from a preventative model? How do we protect ourselves from being able to withstand what could be a traumatic incident so it doesn't affect us so profoundly?
Right. Well, the most profound inoculation against PTSD is a secure attachment in childhood. When you have that strong base, your brain has developed the regulatory capacity to hold you in good standing when there is a trauma, because you have the links between the cortex and the subcortical brain, et cetera. That's not to say that the dysregulation and the instinctive defenses won't be stimulated, but a person who comes from a secure background is likely to be able to re-regulate quicker and not develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So basically, it's like right from day one, depending on how everything was from your childhood up, that's what's going to give you the biggest amount of buffer for handling traumatic incidences when they arise.
And so, you're talking about day one as conception rather than birth. I totally agree. It's a lot can happen in the room, in the womb, of course, that can predispose a newborn.
Well, that's something that I've seen lots too, even with osteopathy with infants. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's kind of hard to explain unless people have been able to see it, because it doesn't always make kind of almost, you know, our conventional logical sense. But you will literally see children like unwind and move in different ways, and you'll see emotions being released during treatments with them, and they go through, it feels like in a lot of ways, they're moving through the different facets of the nervous system that kind of got kind of stuck in place.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can mention some things that you've noticed as far as with that, like, you know, preconception to conception, what are some of the things that parents can do even to, again, create an environment that is going to be more likely to manage stressors and traumatic incidences more effectively?
Mm-hmm. Well, the main thing I suppose that babies need to develop is that integration of the brain, what Dan Siegel calls that vertical integration between the cortex, the limbic system, and the instinctual brain, if we're using Paul McLean's trained brain model. And that's who coined that word auxiliary cortex? I think it was Diamond. Like, the parents really are the auxiliary cortex for the baby because it's not developed, so they have to regulate them. Jaak Panksepp with Amargo Sunderland, I believe is her name, wrote a wonderful book on parenting that's exactly about that, about debunking the myth of letting your child cry, letting them cry it out. And not comforting them. So that's the most important thing, I think. And it depends on the, of course, the kind of traumas that the child has suffered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things when I was reading through some of the work that you've done, Pat, I love the vision that you have on your website when you break it down. And it says, to harness the innate wisdom of the body to liberate human potential. That really resonated with me because it's also a core principle in naturopathic medicine. They talk about the healing power of nature. And one of the key tenets of that is really around honoring that inherent wisdom within the body itself. And that if we can remove the blocks to that, that then there's a spontaneous healing that can always arise. Yes.
after I was reading that, and then I was looking at some of the work from Ron Kurtz, who I really love so much of what he had said too. It's like he really had a way of bringing almost like spirit into healing and healthcare, which I feel like is very, very disconnected a lot of the time. But he had said something along those lines too, around the spontaneity of the healing process that can arise. And I'm wondering if you can speak just a little bit about, from your perspective, what are we talking about when we talk about that innate wisdom of the body to liberate human potential? Like, what is that innate wisdom? How do we gain insight back to it? How do we reconnect to it? Because in a lot of ways, it's never gone anywhere, but we've kind of lost that ability to connect and learn from it. So how does that process begin to reconnect?
Well, it begins, I think, with attitude. Like if a therapist believes in what Ron and I always called organicity, which is a term borrowed from Gregory Bateson, which really speaks to the inherent intelligence in any living system with regard to its own unfolding. And it can't be predicted. You know, it's mysterious, it's very enigmatic. And it has to do with like self-organizing non-linear complex systems. If you believe in that, which I do, then that's the first step with the client, because that creates the atmosphere, I think, where that can just unfold. And in my work, instead of conversation, we focus on mindfulness, what I call embedded relational mindfulness, because it takes place within the therapeutic relationship, where the emphasis is on facilitating a client discovering their own internal organization. So a client comes in and they were, give me a presenting problem, anything, they were raped, okay? I might ask them, okay, when you just think about that incident, what starts to happen inside? So we're getting kind of beneath what's known to a deeper level of organization, kind of a meta level that's driving the content, much of the content of a person's life. When we stay with that organization, a client really learns about themselves. And I think the beauty of it is that, as Ron used to say, if a person gets enough of the right kind of information in that way from really within themselves, there's often a spontaneous reorganization towards help. It's much, in terms of the body, I feel that one of the things that happens with the body is that our natural integrity is adjusted to our environment. So we modify our actions, our posture, our movements, even how we use our voice, according to the feedback we're getting from mostly our attachment figures, the people who are important to us. I mean, and this happens in infancy. Beatrice Beebe and Ed Tronick write about this, that you can discern the meaning an infant is making by their movement and their posture. So if our parents aren't, or our caregivers don't respond when we reach out to them, you know, I'm going to scoot back so people can see, okay? So a integrated reach like this might be, a client might literally pull back, or they might only reach part way, or they might reach with their palm down as if they're not expecting anything back. And I mean, many times in session, I've asked the client kind of diagnostically just to reach out, because it shows how that simple behavioral proximity seeking action has been modified according to the predictions that the person's made of their attachment figure's availability. So that wisdom that was natural and spontaneous, where a child just reaches out, a baby just wants connection, that wisdom gets modified, even when those conditions have changed, you know? So it's just a beautiful thing to help a person reinstate those variety of actions that they've they've adjusted based on their past, you know. I think of it as movement vocabulary.
I like that, movement vocabulary. And do you work with that from either side of it? So can you bring awareness to the physical patterns that the person, where they move in a certain way or they're closed in a certain way, or they, and then they, once they bring awareness to that and they can see it, then they can start to, through the physical changing of that, that starts to change the feeling sense, and you almost kind of work from, like, you know, more concrete to more abstract a little bit as far as how that changes? Or do you start up top with the thinking and then to the emotions and then to the feeling and the sensation and then down to what they're actually doing, or any of it?
You can start anywhere. And you know, a lot of it depends on what the client brings with. Like, often a client will say, oh, I don't get any support in my life. You know, my husband doesn't support me. I just don't have any support. And that's a meaning that they're making. But if you say, okay, this is where the mindfulness comes in. Although I never talk about mindfulness with a client, but I might say, okay, let's stay with that. And if they agree, I'll say, why don't you say those words? I never get any support, and let's see what happens in your body. So then we'll find that mind-body interface. Yeah. And we have different choices, depending on the client's width of their window of tolerance, and also depending on whether we're working primarily with trauma or primarily with attachment wounds. If we're working with attachment wounds, say with that issue, and they have a wide enough window of tolerance, we might go more deeply into that wound. Like the client would say, well, my spine starts to collapse when there's no support. I might say, okay, stay with that. Feel the collapse, sense those words. Is there an emotion that goes with it, or an image? So we start to dive deep into usually what emerges are memories that were formative for that belief and that physical, you know, configuration. And what's the really cool thing about the body in a case like this is research that shows this. Like, if you take on a certain posture, like that collapse in this client example, this research shows that the memories that were the events that were occurring when that posture was operational will just start to bubble up. And that's just fabulous, because, you know, then you get a chance to really rework.
Well, and it's like it's trying to help you out.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right? Like it's trying to bring some attention to it to assist the process almost.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was something else that I really liked when I was reading some of Ron's work, when he talked about once you have the emotion, wait, then the thoughts, beliefs, memories will come because the emotion is present. So just in the feeling sense of the body, that the other stuff naturally kind of arises?
Well, I would probably say that differently. I would say, yes, if someone is tuning into their body and how their body is organized, whether it's their shoulders rounded or hiked up, or they don't feel their legs or their pelvis is tight, whatever, if you stay with that, and that then the emotions, the associations with that pattern will start to emerge. I want to distinguish with emotion, though, because there's attachment-related emotion that, I mean, Bowlby, you know, would say that the most intense emotions that we experience are in the formation, the disruption, and the reestablishment of attachment connections. But if we're working with trauma-related emotions, it's a different story entirely. Pierre Janet called those vehement emotions, like rage and terror. And Janet would say, if you try to process those, it won't go anywhere. It'll just be circular. So that's part of what happened to me in the 70s. I didn't know that. And these women would we'd go into memories and they'd feel scared and I'd try to stay with the fear, and it didn't help. And what I realized later is that those vehement emotions are really designed to fuel instinctive defensive responses in the face of trauma, like that fuel of fight defense. So as a therapist, if a client comes in to work on anger, you know, the first thing I start to think about is this more trauma-related or more attachment-related? Because you've worked with them very differently.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So, because when I think about from different traditions like Zen Buddhism or something along those lines, a lot of it is around staying with sensation. And then mm-hmm. it would be explained a little bit that the emotion is more when we attach a meaning to the sensation, and then that's what we tend to then rev up into like a big forest fire because it's all interconnected to the story around it rather than just sensation. So when you're talking about that with trauma, if someone is feeling a strong fear response and you're trying to get them to stay with the fear, is it, or when you're saying if you got them to stay with the fear, they'd actually get worse. Is it mm-hmm. staying with the fear or is it staying with the physical sensation or how do you work with that then with trauma that's effective?
Yeah, those are two different things. Like in our work, we work with hierarchical information processing, really a top down and a bottom up that has those three segments related to the triune brain, the thinking brain, the feeling brain, and then the body brain. And if you're working with trauma first and foremost affects the nervous system in the body. It affects the instinctive brain. So it is resolved bottom up by working with the body. With trauma, I would have the person stay with sensation, find impulses in the body, perhaps find movements to push away that weren't executed at the time of the trauma, and then we'd execute that motion and movements to run or turn away, whatever the movements were. But we'd really be working bottom up. Because the root of the issue is with the lower brain, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And the dysregulated arousal. And see, if you stayed with the fear, the arousal would just escalate. But the in trauma, I feel like the primary solution to the dysregulated arousal, which often manifests as emotion, is to find the defensive responses that that emotion is fueling, whether it's flee or cry for help or fight back.
Right. And then so you allow the body then to almost finish what it wanted to get started but never got a chance to finish.
Yeah, yeah. Yojane said those who are affected by traumatic memory have not been able to complete the acts of triumph, be able to get away or get help or run away. Yeah. So yeah, we really work with those. But see, the Zen, when you mentioned Zen Buddhism, it's right. If you stay with the emotion, it is likely to escalate. But see, with attachment work, that's what we're looking for, because I want the strong emotion and I want the meaning that they made, because I want to be able to help the client heal that within the context of our relationship. So they have a new imprint of whatever happened to them in the past. So
the emotion then that comes up is bring more awareness to what meaning they've attached to it for an attachment disorder as opposed to a trauma.
Yeah. Yes, as opposed to a trauma. But you know, I don't know if I'd even say disorder, because all of us have attachment issues. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't qualify as a disorder, they all had, because no parent's perfect, you know. I remember having one client of this man come to me, and his big issue was that he played football as a kid, and he felt like his parents really wanted him to play football, and it made them happy and all. He really wanted to dance. He was really into dance and ballet. And his parents, when he talked to them about this, they were horrified. They would have been happy to support this ballet, but somehow it was just a mess. So, but that was a huge wound for him. So even the best of parents, you know, we will wound our kids. I know you have a 2-year-old and 4-year-old, so you can't avoid it.
Oh, no, I'm sure that's all happened already. So. Pat, where is the role of beliefs, and how do you shed light on and bring awareness to underlying beliefs that maybe sometimes aren't so clear for the person, that may be creating patterns that aren't supportive for them?
Uh-huh. I think one of the primary ways is through the body, because the body will reflect and sustain those beliefs. I mean, we make meaning, like Ed Tronick says, in just so many ways. He calls us polymorphic meaning makers, because we make them through our nervous system, through imagery, through muscles, through memory, cognitively, emotionally, so many different ways. But I find the body is a pretty direct access route. So you'll understand this with your body work training. You know, if a body has lost its natural integrity with gravity, it will show up visibly. You know, the head will be forward, the spine will be rigid or collapsed, or something will be going on. The shoulders might be up or rounded, tense, whatever. And if we think of self-organizing systems, you know, our system is affected by our environment. Our very structure is affected by our environment. And so I think of the forces from the environment really impinging on the body of the child. So they form these patterns that reflect and sustain the meaning that they're making. Yeah? So we can, if a client's shoulders are rounded, say, We can say, let's explore that. You know, can you feel that, how they come forward a little bit? And can you maybe just do it a tiny bit more? Like the up to signal just a little bit more and find out what happens, what emotions, feelings, thoughts. Often a memory pops in, because as research shows, that'll t- take us to the events where that posture was operational. And then you can find out. But it can't be from the cortex. It has to be from the body. Like I'll often ask, like, well, if your body could talk, if those rounded shoulders had words, what would your body be saying? And then the belief comes, oh, I have to hide myself. I can't show myself. I'm ashamed. There's a part of me that's not okay. The meaning will just come from the body. And it's so true when that happens. Mm-hmm. So true to the person's authentic experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you're basically finding it's not this intellectual process of trying to figure out what it is, but if you kind of follow the body's guides, then it will spontaneously show you.
Right. Yeah. And that gets back to the whole idea of organicity and living systems, because living systems can't be fixed, you know, and they can't be healed from the outside either. But we can create a context where that healing can emerge. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think of it that way. Like I think even like a doctor can set a bone that's broken, but the doctor can't heal that bone. That comes from the individual, you know. Mm-hmm. But he can create a condition so that healing potential is optimized.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I love that.
I've been so working with an anti-oppression lens, and I notice, you know, because I'm lived many, many, many decades, how pervasive, still using like he instead of they. Or
Pat, are there any specific beliefs that you've seen over and over again that are common ones that, for the most part, a lot of us really, if we come down to it, they tend to be there for a lot of people. Some of the maybe self-limiting beliefs that people tend to struggle with. What are some of the common ones? The reason I want to say that is just because I sometimes feel that a lot of people think they're the only one that has some of these things. And for the most part, it's ubiquitous. And I think the more people hear that, it then sort of allows them to even investigate it more.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many that are common. I think culturally, there's a belief of I'm not good enough. I have to do more. Where there's that feeling that love is conditional on how well we do, not who we are. I think that's ubiquitous in our culture. And there's an isolation that comes with that, like around, like, I got to do it myself. I can't really depend on anybody else. And this is I think a real characteristic of an individualistic Western culture. I think more collectivist cultures, they have a different orientation to community and to performance and achievement. One of my colleagues that I've been working with lately, he's Black and Puerto Rican, and he said, you know, I just don't think in terms of I just think in terms of we. And I've noticed in working with him, it's really true. It's just coming from a more collectivist culture, it's a totally different way of seeing the world and seeing himself. And I don't think he has as much of that drive that people in Western culture have to prove themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that's really common, but there are so many.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. The not good enough, I find, comes up a lot. That's a common one. I think we all sort of struggle with at times. Yeah, as you were mentioning, some of the common ones I find pop up are not being good enough, not being lovable, not being worthy. Those types of things tend to come up all the time. But I really love the approach of working with the body. I feel like that's like something that has taken this old traditional wisdom where I remember Dr. Vanderkolk talking once about when they had the typhoons, I think, in Thailand, and they sent people over to basically try and work with them with all the trauma that was going to be taking place at that point. And he said there was like drug companies there trying to give out SSRIs and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And they said what was really fascinating was that they had community. Yeah. They had sort of rituals and dance and song. And they had all of these things almost just innate and inherent within the culture to manage effectively with trauma without having to do all these other things. And he said there was so much more that really they were just teaching us more than what we thought we were going to come and bring to them. They just did it organically.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was in 1999, Bessel had organized a trip to South Africa. And I went with him on that trip, and we presented at different trauma centers. And I remember this one group of indigenous healers came up to me. They had seen my videos. I just show videos. I'd show and talk about my work. And they said that they really resonated with my work, because they said, we don't really resonate with the brain explanation of trauma, but we see these same symptoms in our people. The shaking and the tense bodies and all of that. But they said it's for a different reason than what you all are talking about. And I said, what's the reason? And they said, in our culture, you have to know the place and the date where the person died. And then a year later, you go there and do a ritual. And if you cannot do that ritual, you haunt it. And that's what you call PTSD, is that people are haunted. And with apartheid, they couldn't find, they couldn't do those rituals. So I thought that was so interesting, how PTSD really relates to belief as well.
Well, and that makes me think, like when you were talking about how literally the nervous system has to run its course. And it's almost like it never got a chance to run its course because of that ritual, which allowed it to finish. But no, it makes me think a little bit about when we were talking before about how you can almost get stuck with trauma in different parts of the nervous system that almost gets stuck and doesn't get a chance to kind of run its course. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that, it sounds like that ritual allows them to almost have some sort of completion with the process of it too.
I think that's true. Yeah. Completion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's beautiful. One other thing I was curious about is if you were familiar with some of the work, and just to, I'm curious about your take on it, but Candace Pert wrote a book called Molecules of Motion a long time back, and she would talk about the neurochemistry of emotion and the neuropeptides, and she would talk about how that literally would be stored within the body tissues. And so talked about almost like the subconscious was actually the body and why it was so important to work with the body in order to metabolize these molecules of emotion, so to speak, in order to then not have them re-triggering over and over and over again. I'm wondering if you're familiar with that work or your thoughts on any of that.
You know, I know Candace, but I'm not a scientist. I couldn't really speak to that on a molecular level. I mean, I think of what Reich said, the body's the manifestation of the unconscious. But he was talking about, you know, blockages and movement, and all that's visible. Mm-hmm. And I definitely with that, and that's at the level that I work.
When you see it structurally or physically in the body and then working with it from almost a postural perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But things change in mysterious ways. And when, like, we have so many interventions of working with the body, and I do feel like what we call sensory motor sequencing, where you're allowing the involuntary movements like the trembling and shaking or the twitches or even the more gross motor movements that seem to be happening by themselves, when you're allowing those to happen, something does shift, especially I think on the nervous system level. I think there's some sort of recalibration that goes on. And maybe that's part of what Candace Pert is talking about, but I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because it does make me think about where the interrelationship is with all of that. I've often wondered that when people are able to shake and just allow the body to do that, what might be going on within the body. It seems to me sometimes like there is a metabolization. There's some sort of metabolism that's going on until it runs its course, and then it just naturally starts to subside, and there's usually a big relief from it.
I think that's true.
I'm curious.
I don't understand on that level how it works, you know, but I've seen it in practice.
If I find anything out about it, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Pat, given the global climate right at the moment, and we are kind of still sort of in lockdown phases with COVID-19, and there's been, really an unprecedented amount of shift that's happened in this world, at least that I've ever seen, and I'm only 48, but that's the most I think I've ever seen as far as something that's affected the entire world. How do you feel from a lens of trauma? How do you feel like this is going to potentially affect people, or what do you think we're going to see after the effects with this? What are your thoughts on it? I imagine you've been immersed in a lot of this over the last while.
Yeah. Well, it is a global trauma for sure. And people are experiencing all kinds of things, the grief to the losses, even anticipatory grief for the losses yet to come. And panic about the future, et cetera. It's going to affect, I think, the long term, it will affect people very differently.
This comes to the end of our time for this episode. Please go to inspirehealthpodcast.com and listen to the remainder of this important episode. Thank you so much.